Lecture 21, Current Applications, Jurisprudence.
In this lecture, I'd like to turn to the subject of law and natural law, and thereby continue in a formal way what we hit peripherally at the end of the last lecture when we were considering questions about God and natural law, the way in which natural law has an impact and should be represented or should not be represented within civil law. In particular, there has been a lot of debate in the last decade and a half about whether it is legitimate to bring principles of natural law into the processes of legislation and, in particular, into judicial review. The subject has arisen in all sorts of venues, including biomedical ethics. We'll save that for Lecture 22, but also things like the congressional hearings that have been held about nominations to the Supreme Court, for example, in the cases of Robert Bork and Clarence Thomas when nominated for seats on the Supreme Court. The one was attacked for an unwillingness to use any form of natural law, especially a liberal stance on natural law for purposes of social reform, insisting instead that he would only argue and decide cases on the basis of a purely positive jurisprudence. The other was attacked for the very hint that he might use natural law, but natural law of a somewhat more conservative bent, on the application to the problems facing the court. In addition to questions like Supreme Court nominations, natural law is also a question with respect to any number of constitutional issues and legislative issues, things that involve tort law, things that involve penal law, and even questions like the nature of our tax system, the graduated income tax. For the purposes of this lecture, what I'd like to do is to focus first on the question of judicial review and the principle of equity. And then, after considering it in terms of the development of that doctrine in our American jurisprudence, I'd like to consider the way in which natural law touches on some substantive issues, in particular things like punishment and taxation. But first, and most importantly, I think here, the very principle of using natural law in judicial review. Repeatedly, in the development of the theory of natural law, its proponents over the centuries have made appeal to a higher law important, that law in terms of legislation and constitution must always consult the standard of objective justice. Whether this is called natural law or higher law, there has regularly been such reference. Law as made by human beings in any of the forms in which we make law, the basic laws that are our constitutions, written and unwritten, statutory law, administrative law, sometimes even just matters of cultural laws that are cultural specific practices. All of these things somehow need to be determined just in order to be law, to be valid law. But on the other hand, to recognize the need for a law to be just in order to be valid doesn't yet decide in practice what we are to do about those human laws, maybe we could call them attempts at human law, that are somehow recognized as unjust. It seems to me that in the review of the history, there have been at least three different attitudes to what we do about those that are deemed unjust. One attitude is that we should declare them null and void, no longer applying. Secondly, is that we might have the court simply declare that this particular piece of legislation is somehow out of conformity with the natural law, and yet refer the matter back to the legislature and not attempt to deal with it itself. A third and a much more aggressive stance is in the form of judicial review as judicial legislation, in which the court not merely declares a law null and void, but actually tries to correct it in some way. One saw that practice, for instance, in the Roman jurists. Whether a judiciary in any given country is given the power to overturn statutory and administrative laws that are somehow perceived to be unjust is a matter that needs to be determined explicitly in a constitution, or if not, the actual practice of the courts over the course of history will have to decide that. In our own situation, the U.S. Constitution does not decide it explicitly, but rather it has been determined by judicial practice over the years. Some cases, in some countries, there actually is a more formal determination. In the German Supreme Court, for instance, has a special division that is a constitutional court deciding on constitutional issues, and only that. The Austrian courts, likewise, have a little bit more explicit power in this matter. But in our own country, there has never been an explicit statement in the Constitution in the matter. It is rather a practice that has grown up, prepared, I think, especially by reason of the operation of some natural law principles in our history, especially the natural law doctrines of limited government, that government isn't all-powerful, and secondly, the doctrine of inalienable rights, namely that there are certain rights that we hold by virtue of being human and having a human nature that are always a kind of trump card. In American legal history, the practice of judicial review began with Chief Justice John Marshall in the case called Marbury versus Madison in 1803. But in that first period, from John Marshall's use of it, through about the 1860s, natural law had only a very limited scope, and judicial review was generally limited to trying to assess whether particular legislation did indeed conform to the Constitution. And there was a great hesitance about invoking any other standards of natural justice that might be used to overturn statutes. So it was a very purely formal matter. It was a matter of looking at procedure of legislation and only about the technical conformity to the Constitution. But there were other moves afoot. In 1793, Chief Justice John Jay, in a case called Chisholm versus Georgia, argued that reason and the nature of things, quote-unquote, was a good reason for trying to decide a case about whether private citizens have a right to bring suits against various state governments. And what Chief Justice John Jay clearly felt was a natural law obligation is that governments are not just under the law of the Constitution, but that governments are also under justice, and hence the private citizens may indeed bring suits to them. Justice Cooley, in the course of the 1860s, begins a movement that I think is very important for the next segment of this and the development of the doctrine. If I try to sketch out the history of the development of judicial review, I would urge that there are three periods when the natural law doctrine starts to grow in judicial review after Justice John Marshall initially begins the practice. The first period will be the 1860s, 1870s, and in that portion of the history of our Constitution and our judiciary, one sees the use by some jurists of natural law in a very conservative way to defend property claims. Secondly, one will see in the 1930s a willingness to use another kind, another insight about natural law for social welfare legislation. And then again in the 1960s and 1970s, one sees all sorts of civil liberties and personal liberties being introduced and defended by the court on what are natural law grounds, at least natural law of a certain sort, under the doctrine of judicial review. So to take the first period, namely a relatively conservative period that I think begins in the 1860s, 1870s, until that time, judicial review had generally been limited to matters of procedure and conformity to the Constitution, and hence one spoke of questions only of procedural due justice. But with the passage of the 14th Amendment and the reinterpretation by the court of the 5th Amendment, the justices moved from a notion of purely procedural due process to questions of substantive due process. I think this may be very useful to think about for a minute. When one is trying to follow the news about various court decisions, those two terms will frequently come up. And if one is clear on that, I think one has a great purchase on what the courts are doing, namely that if it's a question of procedural due justice, all they're examining are formalities about whether legislation was enacted rightly and whether the courts proceeded correctly according to very technical standards. On the other hand, when people start talking about substantive due process, then what is being considered is not just the technical formalities of legislation, but whether people's natural rights or natural liberties or some kind of social right or civil liberty is somehow involved. And it's a more heady use of the court's power. It's not always the case that there's a natural law claim involved, but sometimes there is. In the 1860s, after that passage of the 14th Amendment, Justice Cooley wrote a book in 1868 called Constitutional Limitations. And what he was doing was commenting on the works of Blackstone, whom we met when we were considering the natural law sources for the thinking of our founding fathers. What he urged in his commentary on Blackstone was that questions about private property were very appropriate for the court's consideration, and that in general the judiciary had a right to reverse legislation that had been enacted by Congress, which in any way interfered with private property. One especially, I think, had railroad questions in those days and questions about eminent domain, the taking of property for the sake of a common purpose. And in general, Justice Cooley and a number of his compatriots were urging that there's a natural law protection involved, and hence that there needs to be compensation and not merely the claiming of the land. Justice Cooley, in his book and then frequently in his decisions, urges that the Fifth and the 14th Amendments, considered in light of one another, give judges a far more expansive power here. That is, they can determine not only procedural claims about whether all the formalities have been followed, but that the court is right in considering whether the legislature was considering rightly the needs of the government and the needs of the property holders. One follows thereafter, in the course of the next 30 years, an increasing use of these natural law claims. And I think that they're attributable to one single justice, namely Justice Stephen Field, in the course of the 1870s and 80s, that eventually lead to the famous 1877 case Munn versus Illinois. It begins earlier, though. In 1871, Justice Field writes in a case called the Legal Tender Case. He writes a dissenting opinion. He's not even in the majority. But he starts to make an argument that the rest of the justices eventually buy. In the 1871 case, he's attacking a congressional law that allowed the use of greenbacks, our little green dollars, as acceptable payment for various debts. And he regarded this as something that contravened, quote, the unchangeable principles of right and morality without which society would be impossible. Likewise, he thought it violated, quote, fundamental principles of eternal justice upon the existence of which all constitutional government is founded. That he has a strong sense of private property and is very, very suspicious about various kinds of governmental interference. Likewise, in 1873, Justice Field, again, is in dissent, so he doesn't win the victory of the day on the court's decision on that case, but he begins to get the court thinking in some of these natural law categories of a very conservative sort. It's a case called the Slaughterhouse case, and it was about a question of monopolies, which the courts were deeply concerned about then. Dissenting, Justice Field argues that there is a natural law basis in the 14th Amendment that guarantees the, quote, privileges and immunities of U.S. citizens as a way of guaranteeing all sorts of rights to our property against various infringements by the state. He says they of right they belong to citizens of all free governments. And his suggestion is that this transcends anything that's strictly in the Constitution, that there are natural rights of property. I mean, I think what we're supposed to be hearing here is John Locke's political philosophy, which he very much imbibed and which he very much agreed with, and he's using Lockean natural law political philosophy as a basis for his court decisions in ways that are extraneous to the strict demands of the Constitution. Finally, in 1877, with that case of Munn versus Illinois, Justice Field is a third time in dissent. Here he's interpreting the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment as a guarantee against any interference which the judges deem unreasonable. Now, that's a very strong claim because it's making unreasonable into the important standard that the justices use. But even though Justice Field loses, is on the dissenting side, the rest of the judges, and for the first time, I think, there is a majority opinion that admits in some circumstances, state regulations may be simply so arbitrary as to be unconstitutional. And they have a readiness to buy some of the logic, even if they don't grant him his whole point. Thereafter, for the next 20 years, one sees the majorities using Justice Field's basic argument in the majority opinions. In 1886, for instance, in a case called Stone versus the Farmers Loan and Trust Company, it's a matter of dealing with questions of railroad rate regulations. The court claims that it would be needs to invalidate a statute which, quote, amounts to a taking of private property for public use without just compensation or without due process of law. But it's not just a procedural question here. They're into substantive justice, trying to reinforce property rights. In 1890, the case called Chicago, Minneapolis, and St. Paul Railroad Company versus Minnesota ended up striking down a Minnesota statute for depriving a railroad of the right of judicial appeal, quote, by due process of law, pertaining to questions about the reasonability of those rates. This is an extra-constitutional standard. In 1897, the case of Allgaier versus Louisiana, not only do a majority of the justices on this court accept the view that due process clause here protects in a substantive way property against, quote, unreasonable infringement, but also they extend the interpretation of the liberties that are guaranteed by the clause to the whole realm of the liberty of contracts. And then for the next, well, gosh, until our present day, tremendous defense of the courts of these liberties of contract as a natural law right. Probably the most notorious case in the whole series is the 1905 Lochner versus New York case. This was one that involved striking down some maximum hour laws, that is, how much one could legitimately work. And there was an attempt at social reform to have a certain limited number of hours that a person would have to work every week. And they struck this down on the grounds that it was unreasonable interference with liberty of contract, and hence a violation of the 14th Amendment. Now, that whole domain that I've just been discussing is an effort to use substantive due process on one particular track, namely the track of property and property rights. It's to argue not on the basis of some vague natural law principles, but rather now to make the vagueness consist in the due process clause and allow it to have substantive uses, particular on property questions. It met its opponents, especially in those last 20 or 30 years, when the courts were very inclined to support it. Other justices deeply opposed it. The famous Oliver Wendell Holmes, for instance, is a severe critic when he dissents in the Lochner case. He accuses the rest of the court of using the 14th Amendment to legislate its own economic and social programs into the Constitution. And he urges at one point in the course of that opinion that unless there is a clear and explicit prohibition, the rest of these justices will make the law to be whatever the majority wants the law to be. The debate was getting acrimonious in the extreme. In the 1930s, the court, which was happily going along on its defense of property claims, met Franklin Roosevelt. And one had a whole new dimension, and the dimension of the economic problems that our country was in, which led to a new emphasis upon the need for various social reforms, even if at the expense of private property. At first, the court resisted this, for the court, I think, was newly ensconced in its own version of how to use natural law of a certain sort in property cases. And now there was a strong movement to try to defend social welfare legislation and to use this natural law reasoning, that is, use the claim that the 14th Amendment calls not just for procedural due process, but substantive due process. That is, you can make substantive claims on the basis of extra-constitutional considerations. There was a need, of course, to try to find ways to express this. But once the court backed down and was willing to grant Roosevelt some of his social reforms, rather than have the court expanded, it's that famous switch in time saves nine, when the court stayed at nine justices instead of becoming 15, but adopted much of Roosevelt's welfare legislation, they needed to find rules of law and rules of reason which could allow them to approve and to strike down the legislation that somehow protected these new social reform pieces of legislation. One interesting case is the case of Palko versus Connecticut in 1937. This is a case in which the majority opinion uses the phrase, quote, these rights are implicit in the concept of ordered liberty. Here one has a use of the phrase of rights and ordered liberty, a lot of natural law terminology, to make the case that natural law, not so much natural law in the sense of the nature of a human being, but natural law in the sense of the nature of free society, requires that there be certain guarantees, requires that there be certain kinds of welfare legislation which would be available to those who are in the past otherwise disenfranchised. And one sees progressively in the course of the 1930s and 40s a willingness to do this. In 1938, for instance, Justice Stone, in the case of the United States versus Caroline Products, is asking questions about whether legislation which would be inclined to remove certain social reforms by virtue of popular initiative, whether these things should be given a stricter federal scrutiny. And he argues that, yes, stricter federal scrutiny does come into the court's purview when you have a 14th Amendment case and questions where the courts have to require tests by extra-constitutional standard, where the court will use not just literal formal conformity to the Constitution, but will be concerned with natural rights, especially of disenfranchised groups. And it moves from various social classes to various religious questions and to other groups which heretofore had simply operated in the realm of freedom. Now their rights were to be more explicitly protected. At the same time, one finds justices who disagree with this. In particular, Justice Black is constantly an opponent of it. In the famous 1947 case of Adamson versus California, he urges that these are questions about the interpretation of the Bill of Rights and whether they pertain to the states or whether they pertain to private individuals. Is the court not using somehow a natural law philosophy and substituting its own particular understanding of natural law philosophy for what the Constitution originally intended? And one frequently sees the debate in terms of, should we honor the original intent, if indeed we can know the original intent of the founders of our Constitution, or should we consider the Constitution as a living document, which is in the hands of the jurists to have them expand and develop and to grow it in some organic fashion? The third case of this comes in the 1960s, especially in civil rights legislation. We've discussed that already at some length in the ways in which one saw with 1954 Brown versus Board of Education, and then all the follow-up decisions that continue to defend and expand upon civil rights. But one sees it in other domains as well. There's the famous 1965 case, Griswold versus Connecticut, which had to do with the making available and the selling of contraceptives, and the way in which the court decided that there should be no regulation of contraception with respect even to married couples, let alone to couples who were not married, was on an argument that Justice Douglas makes in which he uses a certain kind of natural law reasoning, namely the rights of marital privacy, and very interesting language. He says, these rights are in the emanations that come from the Bill of Rights. And this is a kind of language in which the courts have often been analyzed to be developing new protections and new liberties which are not explicitly there. And they root this notion in the emanations, or sometimes the penumbra, of the Constitution, urging that somehow their sense of what natural justice is requires this. There was an enormous fight in that case and in subsequent cases in which some of the justices were writing separate opinions about the right of privacy as somehow related to the liberty rights that are stressed in the Ninth Amendment. Other justices are, for instance, Justice Black, whom I mentioned a moment ago, were again worried about a, quote, natural law due process philosophy as giving the court the power to invalidate any legislative act which the justices find irrational, unreasonable, or offensive. This is also the period, of course, of the Miranda case, the 1966 United States versus Miranda, which required that people be informed of their right to remain silent after they are arrested and to have legal counsel before they undertake to answer any questions after an arrest. And the justification for this was certain justices' understanding of what natural law requires, namely the natural law protections that are codified when we presume innocence before guilt and must try to leave a person in that state of innocence and not extract confessions of guilt too soon. Now, as you can see, I think, from this brief rehearsal of the history, there have been uses and abuses of natural law reasoning in jurisprudence. Sometimes for conservative purposes, sometimes for liberal purposes. And I have not tried to sort those out. I've tried simply to describe what's being taken place there. But it has led a number of commentators, in particular Professor Robbie George of Princeton, whom I very much admire in this, to urge that perhaps we would do better to restrict judicial review to purely formal and procedural questions, and instead encourage those who want to use natural law arguments, as indeed Robbie George wants to use, but to restrict those to the political process and to get them out of the juridical process. The alternative, of course, is to say that we depend upon a justice to have justice in his or her heart. But the difficulty, of course, is when in a pluralist society there are extreme disagreements about what that justice consists in, one risks being at the whim of judicial legislation. So it's a very contested problem, and I hope that this account of the history will at least make clearer where the current debate is. The possibilities for using natural law in legislation, of course, are enormous. So here, dealing not so much with how the justices deal with it, but how the legislatures deal with it, let me just propose in the time that remains three examples of places where natural law could very well come with profit into our legislation and then perhaps be respected by the court because they have been included in the legislation. It's not something that the justices have to read into the situation. It's something which the legislatures themselves have assented to. One is the question about the theory of punishment. Various explanations are given for what right anybody has to punish somebody for crime. Among the explanations that are frequently given are deterrence, public safety, and retribution. My point here isn't to settle the matter, but simply to take note that deterrence is not a natural law justification. Deterrence arguments, in which we punish criminals so that other people won't commit crimes because they see how badly crimes are punished, is a utilitarian kind of argument, urging we'll get better consequences in the long run if we do this. I simply point out that that's not a natural law justification for punishment because it doesn't speak to the question of whether this person deserved it. Rather, all we would be interested in is how other people later will react to it. Whereas the justifications for punishment that are found in public safety arguments and in retribution arguments are natural law justifications. Namely, part of the natural law is that a government must be responsible for the safety of its citizens, especially the safety of the innocent, the safety of the vulnerable, the safety of the weak. And precisely in order to secure that common good of safety, the government has an obligation to punish those who are, in fact, convicted beyond a reasonable doubt of a crime in a given situation, that the natural law argument for punishing them comes precisely because of the duty that the government has in justice to protect the safety of its citizens. Likewise, the debt of punishment to a criminal comes as a retribution argument, namely that this is in fact what is due. Here I think of a figure like Hegel, the great German philosopher, who insisted that this is really the only justification for punishment, namely to respect the fact that the person was a reasonable agent and not someone who is simply insane, whom we would do better to confine to a mental asylum, to respect someone who does, out of their own free will, an act which is criminal, requires that we punish them when we catch them, and this is what we owe them to respect their rationality, namely some restriction of their liberty. There are also questions, of course, about how far punishment should go, questions about the time to be served. Here's one of those places where I suspect that natural law has to stand back and say, we can't decide this. It now has to be a determination based upon the more specific considerations of prudence. How long the punishment should be for something, what type of confinement. Natural law doesn't, on the other hand, rule out certain types of punishment as unreasonable and arbitrary. That's the reason why I think we do not torture prisoners. It's a sense that somehow this is an offense against their human dignity, even though they have so gravely offended the community. Questions of capital punishment occur here, of course, because in the case of capital punishment, there is a very, very severe punishment that is being envisioned for a crime. And the question is whether or not this is something that is just. We might ask, for instance, what crimes would be considered to be included on a list of capital crimes. The biblical list, for instance, differs considerably from most civil lists. The biblical list would include idolatry and adultery, neither of which would be presently punishable under civil law. The civil law, on the other hand, tends to focus on crimes like murder and kidnapping, treason and terror. And in doing so, I think is making a very interesting claim about what the purpose of government is, namely to preserve the safety of the people and to identify those crimes especially crimes which cannot be undone, like murder or torture or terror, and to insist that in this case a person has sacrificed some of the natural rights that would normally be present to that person. On the other hand, I don't go too far with that argument, especially when we consider natural rights to be inalienable, then even criminals convicted of capital crimes nonetheless have some ongoing rights. One could consider other matters of taxation, for instance, and note the distributive justice that's involved in which we share the burdens of taxation. But it brings up very interesting questions which could be discussed here. Is a flat rate tax the appropriate sort of tax, or does one require some kind of a graduated tax? Is a sales tax or is a property tax just? These are questions on which natural law, by virtue of its advertence to the nature of justice, the objective and universal claim, could have an interesting role in our legislation.